As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman for our second episode of the week. It's week four. Bruce and I really enjoyed getting back into the rhythm of doing these one show coming off the games, one show going into the next weekend. And just a couple housekeeping items before we get going here. Been a while since we put out this request, but we would love to get your ratings and reviews, presumably your five-star ratings. It helps get the word out about the podcast. So ratings and reviews, if you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it. Also, we've still got a 50% off sale at The Athletic. Go to theathletic.com/theaudible. That is $2.99 a month. Bruce spends more than that per day on coffee. So I don't know why you wouldn't want to spend that for a month's worth of great coverage. Including, The Athletic was the only sports media outlet that had a writer, and it was actually two writers, Nicole Auerbach and Chris Vanini, at the college football playoff meetings in Dallas on Wednesday, where they threw a little bit of a wrench into the that 12-team playoff that we thought might be coming.
Yeah, Stu, so you were at the meetings the last time in Dallas. Maybe that was 2 months ago. I don't even know. It feels like forever ago. A lot has changed since then. So what came out of the meetings yesterday, especially with another meeting set up for next week, right?
Yeah, coming out of that meeting in June, the four-person working group had put together a very detailed proposal for...
And the four-person working group, so people know. That was Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner, Bob Bowlesby, Big 12 commissioner. We obviously know that there's some interesting history that has come to light since then, as well as Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame AD, and Craig Thompson from the Mountain West, the commissioner of that league.
That four-person group had spent 2 years secretly, at least to us, vetting various models, talking playoff expansion, and eventually went public with a very detailed 12-team proposal that was initially met very positively by the group. So when I was at that meeting in Dallas, that was when they presented that plan to all of the commissioners and all of the presidents. There's a president for each conference that technically is their boss. And everybody loved it, and they were going to go back this summer and get more feedback. But the expectation at that time was their next big meeting would be September 28th in Chicago. That's next week. And at that time, we thought that's when they'll rubber stamp it. And then Oklahoma and Texas went to the SEC, and all hell broke loose. And suddenly, that four-person group, like you said, that had been commended at the time for their work, all of a sudden, the other commissioners are like, why weren't we part of this? Why was this done in secret? How could Greg Sankey do that in good faith while also courting Bob Bowlesby's schools? So all of that led to, a lot of paranoia and suspicion. And it's funny because at the time I was like, wow, they really did a good job of, this is much more organized and much more much smoother process than when they went from the BCS to the college football playoff. And now it is exactly like that. Everybody's protecting their own turf. Everybody's got their own agendas. And so that meeting next week in Chicago, where we thought they would rubber stamp something, it's still happening, but they've already said, they came out of the meeting, Bill Hancock said, there's not going to be a vote next week. It's clear from our reporting and other people's reporting that they are now actually, nobody agrees about anything now. And it amuses me as a longtime follower of this stuff, because I do think it was, you could say, a huge conflict of interest, unethical maybe even, for Sankey to still be on that committee, knowing that the Texas-Oklahoma thing was a possibility. That being said, does it really change? Like, if you were the Pac-12, the Pac-12 needs a expanded playoff just as much as it did before Texas and OU went to the SEC. The ACC is one Clemson down season away from needing an expanded playoff. And nobody needs that expanded playoff now more than the Big 12 to bring credibility to their remaining schools. And yet, they were talking about eight teams now. Nobody can agree on when it'll start. It's been an interesting window into how hurt feelings can end up trumping what's actually good for them and good for the sport.
Yeah, I think that it's not entirely surprising, though, given how a lot of times the leadership of the sport can't get out of its own way, right? So I think that's kind of where we're at. I don't think anybody is surprised by any of that, and we'll see what point they get there. Also, obviously, I think one thing that has changed, at least, or something I've heard a lot more from people inside college athletics, is just the feeling of, we need to get more TV partners or broadcast partners involved. It can't be an ESPN kind of monopoly of this. That's not how the NFL has become such a mega business, because there are so many other companies that are involved, and college athletics needs to get out of that by bringing it to open market. And so I think we get to that point.
And that was a legitimate concern even before conference realignment. I mean, I think certainly George Kliakoff, who came from outside college sports, the Pac-12 commissioner, Kevin Warren, who came from the NFL, even back in June, were like supportive of the overall model, but thinking we would be leaving a lot of money on the table. It would be very short-sighted to do it sooner than 2026 when the contract ends, because if you do it any sooner than that, it's going to stay with ESPN. We did learn yesterday, Nicole and Chris were smart enough to ask into this, there is a way for the ESPN owns the rights to all of those New Year's Six games, which are going to be the quarterfinals in this system, and they have first right of refusal if you add new games, which would be these first round games. But I did get the sense that if they really wanted to, they could, okay, ESPN, take your shot, give us your best offer. Oh, we don't like that offer, so we're going to take it to the open market. But no, I think a few of those commissioners are very adamant that they want to wait until 2026. Not just because you can make more money off the playoff by having multiple networks involved, but it also incentivizes Fox or CBS or whoever to invest in the regular season. If ESPN takes over, if there's a 12-team playoff and ESPN has all of it, you could see some of these other networks being like, well, why should we spend money on the college football regular season if we don't even get any of the best games at the end of the year? So that was always a legitimate issue, and as of this moment, I now think it won't happen sooner than 2026. But the idea that now we're reevaluating, the idea that they're now talking about eight teams, which wouldn't have been surprising, right, 4 months ago. We thought eight teams would be the next step. But what we know now about this, kind of where everybody stands, it's never going to happen. Because the SEC is never going to agree to an eight-team playoff where six of the spots are already wrapped up with automatic berths. And then the other conferences, why would they agree to an 18 playoff where they might still miss the playoff? The compromise is to go to 12.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, Stu. So let's talk about what we could get this weekend if we get teams in a playoff hunt right now, right? You have some interesting matchups for this weekend. What is the game you're most curious about?
Well, I'm most curious about Wisconsin-Notre Dame, and I don't know that either of those teams are going to end up in the playoff hunt. You know, you've got Notre Dame 3-0, but looking very shaky. This is, you know, clearly their biggest test so far. And then the last time we really saw Wisconsin was that Penn State game, and they were disappointing. So, Wisconsin's like a 6.5-point favorite. I don't necessarily.
Were you surprised how big the spread was? Yeah. It's not at Camp Randall. It's at Soldier Field in Chicago.
And we've seen Wisconsin's only played two games. One of them, great defense, no offense. The other one, I don't even remember who they played. So, it seems more of that spread seems to be more about lack of confidence in Notre Dame. Given the way they've played so far, especially, you know, I think if you look at this, the real concern for Notre Dame, right, their offensive line's been terrible. They've given up the most sacks of any Power 5 team.
And when can you say, I mean, it's been so long since that has not been a strength of the team. That's the really crazy
part. Yeah, they have been offensive line U for many years under Brian Kelly, and it's clearly their weak spot now, right now. You know, you can always possibly see improvement, but we know Wisconsin's good on defense. If they don't play, if their offensive line doesn't play well,
and they get Leo Chenal back, who's probably their most explosive player, you know what, he can get pressure on the quarterback. That's what he's best at. So, I picked Wisconsin to win by more than 6.5. By the way,
so you like them to cover? Interesting.
I do. You do not?
No, I have Wisconsin 24-20. So winning but not covering. I do think people are being, I don't think Notre Dame is as bad as people are making it out to be. At the end of the day, they beat Purdue 27-13. Is that really the worst thing in the world? I know it was closer than that for most of the game. But they don't seem like they're going to be a playoff team this year. So, it's cool. It's in Chicago. Both Game Day and Big Noon Kickoff are going to it. So, you know, that to me is the headliner game. The other, obviously, very notable one, number 7, Texas A&M versus number 16, Arkansas.
This is going to be a bar fight.
I feel like we know a lot more about Arkansas right now than A&M.
Yeah, I love this matchup just because I was so impressed by how Arkansas just whipped the Aggies' arch rival a couple of weeks back. And we'll see. I think A&M is going to have to look a lot better if they're hoping to win this game. KJ Jefferson has played pretty well. They have some good skill guys, and they're so physical. I still think A&M has more team speed. They have really good running backs. Both teams have really good defenses. I can't wait to see what happens. Arkansas is sitting there at 16. I think, do you feel like that has snuck up on some people?
Well, it's all because of the Texas game. So we don't know yet whether the Texas game was
it more of a Texas thing or more of an Arkansas
thing? Well, like I've said a couple times now, I just think it was a buzzsaw. It was biggest game in years in Fayetteville. Texas had just played a top 25 team. So now if Arkansas comes out and kicks Texas A&M's ass, then shoot, sky's the limit for those guys. I don't know what to expect. I know this, A&M's defense is really, really good. I don't think you're going to see Arkansas do anything close to them, what they did to Texas on offense. But Zach Calzada did not look good in that Colorado game. They beat Colorado 10-7. The next week, Colorado got lost 30-0 Minnesota. So not all that confident in A&M. I did pick them to win. And we'll see. We'll see if they come out looking more like a top 10 team, like they're currently ranked. I don't think they should be ranked that high right now, but that's based mostly on preseason expectations.
Good matchup between really good defensive coordinators, by the way, in this one. Mike Elko is probably as good as there is right now. He's the A&M coordinator. And I think Barry Odom's really underrated. He was the guy who just completely just shut down the air raid and kind of created a blueprint. And I think he's done a really good job. I don't know if he's got as good a D-line as what Elko has to work with, but can't wait for this one. Before we jump out of the picks, I don't want to give away your upset special, but I have a feeling you could drink for free the next time you go to San Antonio.
That's right. I'm on the Roadrunners for the second time this season. They came through for me against Illinois. Let's see if they can catch Memphis sleep. Memphis is a 3-point favorite in that one. See if they can catch them sleeping coming off that big win over Mississippi State. Who do you got as your upset special?
I have a game that is going on. Hopefully it is tonight as we're taping this. It is Marshall against App State. You know, Marshall has a really good running game now to go with along with Grant Wells. And, you know, this one I was surprised a little bit. I get it. It's a road game for the Thundering Herd, but I think this is a really good matchup as well. So I am 3-0, by the way, in my upset special so far this week.
That's impressive.
So
I will say it's a little bold that you are declaring this on the podcast, because I have a feeling most listeners are going to hear this after the game has been played.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that is true.
We've got some great mailbag questions we're going to get to in a second. As always, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. But first, Bruce, I want to ask you about a really interesting story you and Antonio Morales did that went up on The Athletic on Thursday. Again, theathletic.com/theaudible to get 50% off. It's about basically what went wrong for USC and Clay Helton in recruiting, because USC has always been a recruiting juggernaut. And, you know, I saw your tweets. You were just stunned when they put out the list of which college programs had the most players on NFL opening day rosters. And USC was not even in the top 20. So
no, UCLA was in there. South Carolina was in there. USC was not.
And that was a very fast plummet, because in your story, it says in 2016, USC was tied for second for most players in the NFL. 5 years later, not even in the top 20. There are so many. So you guys talk to a lot of people, either who were on the staff under Helton or
parents of players, coaches in the Pac-12 who've coached against them, as well as high school coaches in California.
There are a lot of quotes in here that are like, you know, poor Clay Helton. This story is kind of like a Clay Helton roast. But what stood out to you after doing the reporting that maybe you didn't realize?
You know, a lot of stuff I think people probably had a feel for. Yes, recruiting really, really struggled. And I think a lot of that, you know, right out of the gate, you read the story of like a guy who was a top recruiter or seen as that. He said it's felt like you were going in there all alone necessarily to recruit, because if you're going in for a big recruit, and you're on a home visit, you know, if you're coming up after or right before Nick Saban or Dabo Sweeney or Urban Meyer, nobody looked at Clay Helton and goes, that's a real guy. And that really torpedoed a lot of the recruiting efforts. I think there was that. There was also a part where one of the former coaches, I'm going to read this quote because it's like, it's pretty strong, which is, USC is always going to be ranked top 10 in recruiting, but that's because when you commit to USC, you're all of a sudden, quote, a great recruit. We had coaches in the building who knew the guys at the recruiting sites. He didn't say the recruiting sites, but that's, you know, he referenced a couple specifically. And they'd call them, hey, I need you to rate this kid as a 4-star before I take as a commitment. That's the way that stuff works. If we sign 25 kids, there are 10 of them that were that way. We had so many 4- and 5-star guys who were just terrible. We signed 1 5-star linebacker, and he would be a really good player 30 years ago when it was just going from A-gap to A-gap, but not these days when you got to be able to tackle perimeter screens now and go sideline to sideline. Look at all those cats Alabama's running around with. Saban turns down 10 5-stars a year because he knows they're not good enough. And so I think that's another part of the chasing stars and getting caught up in it. I also think beyond the recruiting part of this, and that's a big part of it, but also it was not just a lack of accountability, but just how USC really lost its way. And you'd hear that from coaches in the league. And one of the coaches I talked to was from the Pac-12 North, had made the point they lost it in the trenches. They, if you want to really win championships, you got to be able to run the ball and be physical up front. And they can't, because part of that was going to the air raid. And you bought into that mentality, and it might look good and you might get good stats, but that changes the mentality of your team. As this guy said, USC turns soft. It is, it just is what it is. And I think, you know, some of the stuff Antonio and I get into from hearing from a lot of people who either were in the middle of it or kind of dealt with it, I think the things were, yes, it was bad. Yes, it was misevaluation of recruiting. Yes, it was going after the wrong guys. It was not being able to win head-to-head battles with the programs who are actually competing for national titles. But then it's also the day-to-day. You know, we've talked about this on our podcast before. USC has had a Monday through Friday problem as well. They did not practice with the intensity or the physicality or, quite honestly, the accountability you need to develop players. And I think that's the things, those are the things that really gutted USC football. And, you know, the people who read the story will see, okay, they do have some assets to build up going forward. Like this, like I had one of somebody I work with who is a big USC person said before, you know, before he read the story, he's like, is this going to really depress me? And I said, well, there's parts at the end of the story that are going to probably could make you optimistic if they make the right moves going forward. That's the big question, because a lot of times, and you know this well, living on the West Coast, it just seems like USC has made the wrong choices. If there's like two roads, they almost always have gone the wrong road in the last decade.
I just real quick want to circle back to that quote about this. This is not some outside guy with a conspiracy theory. This is a guy who was on the staff saying that other assistants would call up the recruiting sites and say, hey, can you move this guy up to a four-star? This is something that fans have always suspected happens, not just with USC, but with other big-name programs. Here's a guy basically confirming it. I don't want to say I'm surprised. Nothing surprises me in recruiting. But I actually think that the recruiting sites do a really good job in their evaluations. And they want to be right, you know, more than anything. They know they're going to be judged on, hey, people looking at those rankings 4 years later and being like, how good a job did they did? So it just does surprise me a little bit that they would do that. And certainly with 10 of 25 guys in a class, knowing that it could backfire like that.
Well, look, some of it, and you know, I wrote a book about recruiting, and it's still, you know, I think it's the recruiting sites are better than they were back then, but they're still kind of beholden to a lot of the coaches, college coaches, for a lot of information and intel on players and expertise. It's not to say that no one doing evaluations doesn't have credentials, but at some point, I think you got to remember they're also recruiting reporters who are involved in this process. So yeah, they see it, but also they're really tracking what the kid is thinking, what the kid's family may be thinking about where they're going. I mean, it's really complicated, right? So the NFL has way more information on their evaluation process, and they get it wrong a lot. But
I actually think recruiting rankings end up being slightly more accurate than how the NFL draft plays out.
I don't think that's true. But the reality of it, Stu, is when you're dealing with recruits, you're dealing with way more of a development piece, right? In terms of the guy somebody is going up against in high school football is probably not going to be a college football player. Right, unless you're like playing at Hobart College in Division III, you know, you're probably going up against somebody who's relatively athletic, right? It's not to say that there's not like wide disparities of that in college, but also bodies change a lot, right? I mean, Andre Dillard was a 6'5", 235-pound guy when Washington State took a chance on him, and he ended up to be a first-round pick, but like, you know, a lot of these guys, I mean, I got Northern Iowa guys on my freaks list the last couple of years. those guys have put on 100 pounds since high school. You know, so it's just, there's just a lot of different aspects of physical development and emotional, you know, development that go into the recruiting process. It's harder, but I, you know, again, I thought this was a really interesting window. There's another quote in there that, you know, you talked about kind of behind, a little bit behind the curtain, where it was got into the paying for players aspect of it. And I thought that was, you know, when I heard it, I was like, there's a lot of stuff we have in this story where I feel like it is usually, if you have a strong quote or an eye-opening quote, one or two in a story, you feel like, wow, I can really, you know, that's going to carry a lot of weight. In this one, you know, like, and there was a bunch of stuff Antonio got that I, when I read it, I was like, whoa, that's a good way to end that section, you know,
yeah.
Whether it's from a parent of a player or a high school coach. And, you know, I just thought it was, there's just a lot of stuff that kind of blew away. I mean, again, I'll read part of this. There's probably 20 or 30 kids, 20 kids a year, maybe 30, that are getting paid big money to play college football, the former assistant said. The vast majority are quarterbacks and D linemen. We had multiple staff meetings where Clay said, if you get caught cheating, you are being fired. His thing was, if they fire me, it's going to be for losing, not for cheating. USC was coming off scandal, and he'd been part of that staff coming back. We couldn't play the game the way the game is being played at that level. Now with NIL, you can do it, which is why they created the Boulevard. That's USC's in-house partnership, which is, you know, helping their student athletes, you know, drive market value. That is going to be huge for them. That's actually the part, this part is probably where I would be, if I was a USC fan, where I'd say, okay, there's a reason for optimism there.
Gary Patterson, speaking to TCU boosters this week, flat out didn't even try to shy away from it. Basically said, we need you to start paying players. Everybody else is taking advantage of NIL. We need to, if we want to sign big time guys, you guys need to start paying these guys, obviously via legit NIL deals. So I know that's the thing that everybody fears about NIL. Everybody thinks that's going to be the downfall of college football. We will see how pervasive that becomes.
Gary Patterson basically went on the, I don't know, he didn't necessarily go on the record. He was quoted as such. But that's the kind of thing where we had a story in June about a coach saying almost that very same thing. Now, that coach was not in the Big 12, was not Gary Patterson. But I was like, man, that's basically exactly what Gary Patterson said.
All right, let's get to the emails. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. All right, Bruce, this first question involves something that you've got a direct stake in from Derek, who is an Iowa fan. How has the Fox Big Noon kickoff experiment gone overall? I'm sure it's helped viewership, but as fans, it feels extremely disappointing. As an Iowa fan, I'm pretty devastated at the idea of hosting Penn State on October 9th with a likely noon Eastern, and I guess for him, 11 a.m. Central kick.
All right, Stu, obviously, full disclosure, I work on that show. I work at Fox Sports, so take it with a grain of salt.
I think he's talking, though, about the noon game, not the show.
No, I get it, but that's like, it's all tied together in the strategy. That's why it's there to help prop up the pregame kickoff show, which is obviously going up against a juggernaut in College Game Day. But what it also does, and I think it has been a huge ratings driver for Fox Sports. It's been a huge ratings driver for the show before it. It's certainly in that window to own that noon window when, quite honestly, the brain trust at Fox Sports evaluated what's in that noon Eastern window on Saturdays. And the games typically were not very strong. Why are we going to throw up a huge matchup against the ABC primetime game, or when there's a lot more stuff going on later in the day? Let's hit it out of the park right out of the gate, especially because Fox has the Big Ten. And the Big Ten, it's, you know, if we were talking about this 15 years ago when USC was rolling under Pete Carroll, when USC was everything and in the top program, it's harder to say, hey, we're going to stick them, you know, if you have the Pac-12, stick them at the 9 a.m. window every week. But with Ohio State,
with Penn State, Michigan, Wisconsin, especially, especially Ohio State, those games do big numbers. And what happens is not only do those games do big numbers, we've had, we being Fox Sports, we've had some huge numbers after the big noon game in that 3:30 window that come off of the game, because a lot of times it's what your lead in is. So I totally get what Derek is saying. And when he says, I'm sure it's helped viewership, it has helped viewership exceptionally well. And so that's why that experiment has gone over so well for from the Fox Sports side, and they're paying millions and millions of dollars for it. And that's for those leagues, and that's why they've done it.
I mean, I think we can stop referring to it as an experiment at this point. It's clearly here to stay. It has been a massive success for them. I'll give you a few numbers here just from the first three big noon games this year. This is from sportsmediawatch.com. Penn State, Wisconsin, 5.4 million viewers. That was up 106% from that window in 2019. Oregon, Ohio State, and of course, it helps that you have great matchups. Oregon, Ohio State, 7.73 million. That was up 64% from 2019. Nebraska, Oklahoma this week, 4.2 million, up 38%. Those are huge, not from last year when everything was down, but from 2019. Here, the other thing I would say is, look, I get it. 11 a.m. kicks. I went to Northwestern. It seemed like all their games were at 11 a.m. Not the most ideal thing. However, I covered the Ohio State-Oregon noon game, and I have to tell you, and look, I'm not out tailgating before the game, so I'm not necessarily representative of the average fan experience, but like, it's my absolute favorite window for covering games, because you get to go home or to a sports bar or wherever and watch all the rest of the games, right? You see your game, and then you get to see all the 3:30 Eastern, the set, even right through to Pac-12 after dark, whereas if you're at a 3:30 Eastern game, you usually miss everything before and after it. And of course, night games, I'm just an old man who doesn't want to stay up that late. But I think it's great that we have. I can remember for years and years, game day would end and it'd be like, all right, time for the Purdue-Illinois game. You know, it was just such a dead window. And now you get some of these big blockbuster games.
And full disclosure, Stu was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars by Fox Sports previously, given back rubs by Dave Wannstedt. So you know where you're getting from him too. All right, Stu, this next question is from Tate in Kansas City. Hey, Stu and Bruce, really enjoy the podcast. Thank you. Wanted to get your thoughts on K-State so far this season. While not world beaters, the Wildcats managed to dominate a Stanford team that has gone on to put up points against other Power 5 opponents. They lost their starting QB before overpowering Nevada, a team with possibly the number one pick in the draft. That's Carson Strong he's talking about. The defense is particularly salty, giving up only 164 yards on the ground through three games. K-State opens Big 12 play against a vulnerable Oklahoma State team and could be 4-0 when OU comes to Manhattan, potentially when Skylar Thompson, their quarterback, returns. Are people sleeping on Chris Klieman's group in a year when the perceived leaders of the conference look shaky? This is a good question, Stu. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with everything he's saying. I actually wrote about them in the mailbag this week. You know, you look at a lot of these teams haven't played anybody through 3 weeks, so you don't know much about them. K-State almost shut out Stanford in the first game. Stanford has scored 42 and 49 in the 2 weeks since then. And like you said, you might scoff at Nevada, but Nevada's got a possible first-round quarterback in Carson Strong. They beat Cal. And K-State shut them down too. So if nothing else, I think we can safely say Chris Klieman's team has a heck of a defense. They've also got one of my favorite players in college football, Deuce Vaughn, the diminutive running back who seems to go for 120 or so every week, usually has at least one explosive touchdown. The issue, like you said, Skylar Thompson's out this week. He's been their heart and soul quarterback for, seems like, he did play for Bill Snyder. He may have even played for Bill Snyder his first go around. And so they're playing in Oklahoma. I say all this, I'm heaping them with praise. I don't know if they're going to beat Oklahoma State this week. Oklahoma State, have you noticed that how much that program has changed in the last couple of years? We always think of Oklahoma State as this team that would throw the ball around, score 40, 50 points, and give up 40, 50 points because they could never play defense. They beat Boise State 21-20 last week, completely shut down Boise's offense, and that's kind of their thing now. Like, they run the ball. They haven't had great quarterback play in the last few years, so they run the ball, and they actually do have a really good defense.
Yeah, Jim Knowles, former Duke assistant, done really well there. Stu, I noticed this. It surprised me. First of all, I got to be honest. I was surprised that the spread is Oklahoma State. I get it. It's in still orders a 6-point favorite. That surprised me that the spread was that. I actually picked K-State to win this game. I was surprised that you didn't, because I checked the, went back and looked at your picks. Why do you like Oklahoma State more than K-State after everything Tate laid out? I know you said that Oklahoma State's defense is much improved.
Yeah, I mean, I think if Skylar Thompson's playing, I pick K-State. Will Howard had struggled last year. He looked good against Nevada. I just don't know how he's going to do against that Oklahoma State defense. It's a toss-up game to me. By the way, if you are intrigued about this game like we are, you're going to need an ESPN Plus subscription to watch it. That's where the number 25 Kansas State against undefeated Oklahoma State, that is an ESPN Plus game, which has become a real point of frustration among Big 12 fans that some of their decent games. In fact, this is Kansas State's third game in a row on ESPN Plus. You know how I know that?
I don't.
One of their players complained about it after the game last week. He viewed that as a sign of disrespect. So,
win this game and maybe you'll change it. But to do that and to kind of break through to where Tate is talking about, just on your point about no Skylar Thompson's Will Howard, it's funny. I watched some of the game and I did see Will Howard throw one nice deep ball. But one touchdown, three picks so far on offense from the K-State passing game. It is going to have to get a lot more efficient to make a run at being a top 10 team this year.
Yeah, and it's hard. You know, with Oklahoma State, it's going to be hard to beat them one-dimensionally. We will close it out with Brad, who says, "Hi, guys. I think Pat Narduzzi has done a fair job during his time at Pitt. He has upgraded the facilities, recruited well, and provided stability to a program that needed it. Having said that, in his seventh season, a loss to a mediocre MAC program, Western Michigan, is unacceptable. At this point, he seems to have taken the program as far as he can. Thoughts about possibly replacing Narduzzi and who may make sense?" It does feel like he's kind of down to, like, this is a make or break year. They really haven't ever had a big breakthrough. Even the year they went to the ACC championship, they went 7-7. So you have another kind of 500 type season. I can't imagine them continuing to stick by him.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny because they have a pretty good record in ACC play. I'm just looking at it now. In the last 3 years, or since he's been there, 29-21. But you're right. I can see why fans, waiting for that breakthrough year. The fact is, they've never won more than 8 games. Now they've won 8 three times. With Kenny Pickett, you felt like maybe they had a chance. They had a decent road win at Tennessee. Not that Tennessee's that good, but then they kind of sputtered. I feel like defensively, they just weren't good enough the other day. You know, I was watching that game or some of it, and that's been the challenge. If they were to make a change, to me, the guy I think would be probably tempting for them, especially the way the season's shaping up, is Joe Moorhead. Joe Moorhead is from Pittsburgh. He's a really good offensive coach. You saw him. Basically, he's a big part of why Oregon out-coached and out-schemed Ohio State on the road the other day. And we know he has good head coaching experience. He was really good at Fordham. He didn't get much of a chance. It wasn't obviously a great fit at Mississippi State. They pulled the plug after 2 years. But if Pat Narduzzi can't, if they end up making a change at some point, whether it's this year or whether it's next year, I think Joe Moorhead's the guy they should be looking at if they do want to make a change.
That makes perfect sense. I remember being very puzzled why he took the Mississippi State job. I know it's tempting to want to become an SEC head coach, but no familiarity with that area, and you're at a program that already is at a bit of an inherent disadvantage to a lot of the teams in its division. He wasn't there long enough to really get a full read on it, and I know things got really ugly off the field at the end. There was like a big fight in practice that I'm trying to remember. Somebody punched somebody and it wasn't good. And it affected their bowl game. But, that would make a lot of sense. I do think Pitt is a program that should be better. They have been mediocre for so long that I don't think anybody, like, I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this don't even realize Pat Narduzzi, like, may have no sense of how he has done, but it is pretty 8-5, 8-5, 5-7, 7-7, 8-5, 6-5, 2-1 so far. And they're in a division where there is. Well, you're in a division, you know, everybody knows the ACC Coastal is not exactly a world beater division.
So I would ask you this. So you're Heather Like, she's the AD there. She supported him, you know, pretty strong. They do have to play Clemson at home, and they get North Carolina at home later than that. If they go 8-4, you're Pitt. Are you really going to make a coaching change, though?
I think if Oregon is in the playoff and Moorhead is available and interested,
you're going to pull the plug on Pat Narduzzi at 8-4 at Pitt?
Is that your? I mean, I just feel like you're really settling if that's considered your.
You're 8-4 at Pitt, though. I mean, like if you're 5-7, yeah, I could see it. If you're 8-4, do you do it? Think about it.
I think, I mean, look, you never know how's, if it's 8-4 and includes a win over Clemson, that's going to look a lot different, right? So it's hard to say exactly, but I just feel like it's kind of reached a point of where it's getting harder and harder for people to genuinely believe he's going to lead them to glory.
8-4, out the door. You are a tough boss, Stu Mandel. You hear that, John Hayes? You better make sure.
Get fired for going.
You hear that, John Hayes? You better make sure.
9-3.
You better make sure Andy Staples is feeding Ari Wasserman like bacon fat to eat on TV to get the ratings up, or else Stu's going to run them both at the building.
Our guy Dave Wannstedt got fired for. Wow. He got fired after going 7-5, but tying for first in the Big East that year. That does seem pretty heartless. So he probably does make it at 8-4 if that's kind of the Pitt standard there. But I would trade him for Moorhead tomorrow. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. Again, like we said off the top, if you enjoy the podcast, please go and give us a 5-star rating on Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll see you next time.